So I'm going to give you a brief guide. When I was in my teens and during the time that speed reading was in vogue, I decided I would try it out on a Russian novel. So I chose Crime and Punishment. I was about halfway through it when I realized that Rodion Raskolnikov and several other names were all the same person. I thought there were four people going on there. So here's how it works. There's a surname, Familia. That one's pretty obvious. There's a Christian name, Imya. And then there is Ochestva. Ochestva is the patronymic. Now, some languages use patronymics, such as Norwegian and Swedish, but Russian certainly uses them. And if you're on friendly terms with somebody, you're more likely to use the patronymic than the first name. So the patronymic is derived from the father's first name, whether you're a woman or a man. And for a man, it ends in Ovich or Yevich, and for a woman, Ovna or Yevna, okay? So if you see those endings, then you know that's a middle name or a patronymic, all right? So Ivanovich is son of Ivan, or son of John or Johnson. By the way, I'll put all these PowerPoint slides on Blackboard when we get set up.
So Fyodor Mikhailovich Dostoevsky.
Yep, and he's son of Michael. Michelson. Mikhailovich.
Fyodor Mikhailovich
Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky, yeah. That's the way it works. Okay. Now, we're going to go back to the Middle Ages. I'm going to talk about a certain theme. There are three or four themes going here. One is the theme of modernization. That's what we're going to talk about today mostly. Modernization is extraordinarily important for an understanding of the Russian novel. But at the same time, modernization was never quite complete in Russia. There was always a tendency, nevertheless, to hang on to the core of what Russians thought of themselves as. And this brings us to the very contradictions and conflicts that Dr. Cowan was talking about last time. And we will look at, very briefly, you won't have read it. I'll locate a translation and put it online for you, of one of Pushkin's most famous poems, in fact, one of the most famous poems in the Russian language, and a verse novel, also by Pushkin, and the first important Russian novel, which we will not be reading, published just a year before Dead Souls, called A Hero of Our Time. And in all of this is wrapped up a whole group of themes. So traditionalism versus modernism, styles of architecture, matters of religion, the opposition between East and West, Westernizers and Slavophiles, although Slavophiles aren't necessarily opposed to the West, it gets a little bit more complicated than that. Westernizers are usually modernizers, but you have all kinds of shades of these two opposing tendencies in the 19th century. Now, what we want to work up to is the 19th century, and we want to see how this functions. In a book called The Positive Hero in Russian Literature, this is from our library and I'll return it. Good director that I am, who wants to have all the books on the shelves so that everybody can get to them. So please do not lose books and please do not keep them out beyond your allotted time. Anyway, this is by Rufus Mathewson. And the positive hero he's talking about extends well into the Soviet period. But I want to explain what he means by a positive hero. And so I'll begin with the whole question of problematic literary heroes. It turns out this is very old. It's not a 19th century invention at all. In fact, it goes back to the earliest text, some of the earliest texts that we have in Russian literature. Now, to begin with, Russian literature is largely a medieval affair until the end of the 17th century. There is the beginning of, I wouldn't exactly call it a modern literature in the 17th century, but some Western influence begins to creep in the course of the 17th century. However, most of that literature, all the way through the 16th century, is religious in character, and for a long, long time throughout the Middle Ages, there are really only two kinds of narratives. There are saints' lives, which are by and large dominant, and much of this literature was written by monks and by ecclesiastics, and so you have a widespread and overwhelming tradition of these things. There are a few folk tales, but they get rarely written down. And then there are lives of heroes and famous men. There is a tradition in Russian literature of the short heroic ballad, the Byulina, and the Byulina, plural Byulini, is a kind of combination of epic recital and folktale. Now, one of the, well, clearly the most important of these is the song or lay of Igor's campaign. And by the way, that's not pronounced Igor, but Eager, as in E-A-G-E-R, Eager. So the song of Igor's campaign, we think it was probably first set down in 1187. That is a year after the event it describes, and this is because of some internal evidence and also because there are some parallel medieval chronicle texts that mention the same event. This is a very interesting, well, I was going to say poem, but it actually isn't a poem. Or if it is, it's in a very loose form of verse. It's actually in prose, but it's rhythmical prose. And I will put a copy of it online for you so you can read it for yourselves. It's not terribly long, as a matter of fact. But it's a very peculiar heroic poem. So, as I'm talking here, of course, you're distracted from me by the words on the screen. That's intentional. But I also did this because if I put this, when I put this online, you'll have all of this already for you. So there were four rulers. This is during the Kievan period. There are four rulers, and they go out to fight the Cumans, one of the tribal groups that make up these various, sometimes allies, sometimes enemies, Turco-Mongols, Tatars, and so on. And they had gone back and forth against the Cumans. Now, there was no united Russia at this time. So these are the Rod, R-O-D, the Rod. And by the way, I should insert in parenthesis here that the word Narod, N-A-R-O-D, means the people as a whole. And nationalism in Russian is Narodnost, Narodnost. So that's translated as nationalism, but it really means the unity of all of the peoples of Russia. So nationalism sounds rather abstract, but Narodnosti is not quite so abstract. It's more the soul of the people.
How would you spell that in the Latin alphabet?
N-A-R-O-D-N-O-S-T. And sometimes you'll see a little apostrophe after the T. That means it's a palatalized T, but we won't worry about that. You don't need to fuss over these small matters of details of pronunciation. Sorry. All right, so there are four related men here. Each of him has his own is a leader of his own domain. And the funny thing about this is that they suddenly decide one fine day to go out and fight the Cumans. They haven't been provoked recently. They just decide to stage a preemptive strike. And so they go out, Igor, his brother, Vsevolod, their nephew, Vyatoslav, and Igor's young son, Vladimir. It's kind of hard to know where the accent falls in Russian, by the way. I just misplaced one of them. Vsevolod. Okay, Sviatoslav and Vladimir. 3 days later, they've been defeated and captured, all of them. And they spent a long time captives of the Cumans until somehow Igor manages to escape as his son, Vladimir, marries a princess, the daughter of his captor. One of them, we gather, because we don't hear about him subsequently, was slain. And his brother is later either freed or escaped somehow, where it's not clear from the text. But he is later free. Now, the odd thing about this is that you cannot imagine this as a heroic tale. And yet, it's presented with all the trappings of the heroic tale. What's going on here? It's the beginning of something in Russian literature and in the Russian soul. That is, the Russian notion of a people who are frequently defeated and always and being put down and disunited on the one hand, and with romantic notions of heroism and bravado. And so Igor becomes a kind of prototype. I mean, he was an historical figure, but in this poem, he is treated with great honor as a great man. And his deeds are great deeds, even though he loses the battles that he fights in. Strange, isn't it? But it's the beginning of what we might call, ultimately, the ironic Russian hero. And we're going to see a whole lot of that next time. But we'll wait till next time. Or I will. I don't know about you. I hope you're already deep into dead souls. All right, so that's one side of this. Now, let me read here a bit from this book by Matthewson. On the one hand, in the 19th century, as the novel begins to emerge, we get two kinds of heroes. One is the descendant of Igor. He's problematic. He isn't quite like the typical hero that we get in other literature all over the world. But at the same time, there is, and it's, by the way, the hero tends to be predominantly tragic in character, or if not in character, at least the events in his life are largely tragic. Now, Igor doesn't have exactly a tragic ending, but you can see already he's an ambivalent kind of hero. There was a call for a positive hero. Now, the positive hero is, of course, the saint. And so here we have all the saints' lives to look at. And the saints' lives provide us with a positive hero, but a very quiet hero, generally. Not necessarily, however, as we'll see, because there is one positive hero who is extraordinarily important in the subsequent history of Russia, and he lived a century later. So important is he that there are churches outside of Russia, in, say, Bulgaria and Lithuania, named in his honor. And his name is Oh, by the way, forgot to tell you the rest of this. You can catch up with it later. Okay, so, by the way, I should mention that this was published only in 1800, somebody had copied it down in the 16th century. And then it, unfortunately, was destroyed in a fire, but they at least had copies of it in records. Okay. This is Aleksandr Yaroslavich Nevsky. He, if you look down at the bottom of the page, he was glorified by the Russian Orthodox Church in 1547. After Peter the Great created St. Petersburg and established the Aleksandr Nevsky Lavra, or main monastery in St. Petersburg, he had the remains of Aleksandr Nevsky, that is now St. Aleksandr, moved to the monastery. And they're still there today at the end of Nevsky Prospect. All right. Catherine the Great then created an order of Aleksandr Nevsky in the later part of the 18th century. On September 24th, last year, he was declared the main hero of Russia's history by popular vote, and he was voted the greatest Russian ever in a television poll. So, eat your heart out, America's Got Talent. Russia has a saint and a hero. What kind of hero? Well, he is the outstanding figure in military and political events in medieval Russia. So, as you can see, he was ruler of Novgorod, new city. That's what it means in Russian, Novgorod. It's a very old city, and it is to the southwest of Petersburg. And if you go to Petersburg, you can take a nice little four-hour trip down there and visit it. And Vladimir, and therefore, as the ruler of Vladimir, he was the ruler of Russia as a whole. So now we begin to get the beginnings of united Russia. There's a famous film, have you ever seen it? Aleksandr Nevsky by?
Eisenstein.
Eisenstein, precisely. Soundtrack by?
Shostakovich.
Close, a little bit older, Prokofiev. You've probably heard this music somewhere.
Uh-huh. I just thought I'd say it's playing in the Dallas Symphony Orchestra this semester or next.
Yeah.
Oh.
Really?
Well.
Just saying.
Yeah. It might even be on iTunes. Who knows? Okay. Great. Well, see, we're right up to date, aren't we? Dallas is. But it's a very popular piece of music. Prokofiev, the soundtrack was awful in the original, and so Prokofiev made a concert piece out of the movie music later. All right, Aleksandr Nevsky gives us a couple of other themes that are very interesting. One is he had two key military victories. Now, in the 13th century, the Russians had been for a long time having problems with a family of Germans, and this is what the movie is about. The victory on Lake Peipus, which is frozen over, and a small number of Russians defeated the cumbersome German warriors in their armor on the ice in a key victory. And then later, he defeated Swedish invaders on the Neva River. And this is where his name comes from, Nevsky, because of the victory on the Neva. Now this is doubly important for when we leap forward rather substantially to the 18th century, because we'll see the Swedes are still a problem for the Russians and the Neva River is still important. He collaborated with the Golden Horde. In other words, he worked with the Mongols to stave off the Scandinavians and the Western Europeans, that is, the Germans. And so he played his cards rather well in this instance. Now, let's see. What about Russia? Russia is a huge expanse. Extends to almost 1/6 of the world's landmass. Over the centuries, it has had various territories. The old Soviet Union, which included a number of countries that we don't think of as Russia and we don't call Russia, nevertheless includes areas that were historically part of the Russian Empire in the past. Lithuania, by the way, was alternately under German control and Russian control, and of course now it's independent. Estonia, likewise. Ukraine, the capital of what was the capital of Ukraine, Kiev, was of course the capital of Russia in its origins. Bielorussia, or White Russia, was also considered a part of the Russian Empire. And all the way down south to Chechnya, and so on and so forth. Chechnya is still part of Russia, but a lot of these, you know, all the stans, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and all of these, came into the Russian political influence later. As late as the 19th century, they're still, and in Lermontov's A Hero of Our Time, they are treated as, in fact, remote, dangerous, and rather barbaric outposts. Okay. 150 different ethnic groups and different languages. And people don't realize that even Russia now includes a lot of Muslims. It became a world power, however, only in the first half of the 18th century, thanks to a conspicuous man, and he was conspicuous in more ways than one. He was 6 feet, well, I get conflicting figures. Some say 6 feet 6 inches tall, some say 6 feet 8 inches tall, but yeah, some say seven, yeah. His size grows with his reputation. And there he is. And there's good reason to call him Peter the Great. I have an idea how tall that is because both of us knew him at Yale. William Wimsatt was 7 feet tall. They called him one of the giants of the English department. There's good reason. All right, so he was born in 1672 and he died in 1725. According to a story, after rescuing a couple of soldiers who had fallen in the ice, but he had been not taking too good care of himself before that, and so he died shortly after that particular event in 1725. It would be hard to exaggerate the impact of Peter the First on the subsequent history of Russia. Now, let's look back at these centuries that take us between Saint Alexander Nevsky, by the way, the warrior saint. Pay close attention to that. Religion and politics have never been separate in the history of Russia, not even during the Soviet Union and the communist era. And by the way, it was Peter the Great that put the Russian Orthodox Church under state control. All right, so you,
Just a thought, was that like Henry VIII usurping, or was that like done with the consent of the Ecumenical Patriarch saying, I'd like to be able to kind of
church
in this area to teach?
Yeah, it was not like Henry VIII.
Okay.
It was an organizational sort of move on Peter's part.
It wasn't like he started trying to declare doctrine or something.
Oh, no.
Okay.
No. He wasn't head of the church.
Well, neither was Henry VIII, but he tried to be.
Well, actually the king or the monarch of England is head of the Church of England.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there you are. All right, what did Peter the Great do? Well, what didn't he do? In a minute, I'm going to read you about the positive hero. But this brings us to this question of the positive hero now, before we look at some of Peter the Great's achievements. The positive hero is not only somebody you can look up to, but he is impeccable. And he is, by the way, depending on who's running the show, he is politically correct. Always. There is nothing ambiguous about him. He is not just a good guy. He's a really good guy. He is a model for how everyone ought to be and behave. This is the positive hero. The positive hero hits his heyday during the time of the communist regime and the Soviet Union. That's why so many of the novels are so awfully dull. Now, during the course of the 19th century, critics were constantly lamenting that there wasn't a positive hero. Where are our positive heroes? All right, so I'm going to read you now, finally, from Matthewson. Of the critical controversies that nourished the literature of the 19th century, none was more intense than discussion about the kind of significance that should be invested in the figure of the literary hero. The politically minded critics, Belinsky, Drobolyubov, and Chernyshevsky, who made specific, insistent, and programmatic demands on literature. So, you see, on the one hand, there's literature that, and this is what you get, there's literature that tries to be realistic, show things as they are, or romantic, you know, things that are wildly imaginative. And then there's literature that says, no, a literature ought to present us with models. So critics like Bielinski, who's very important, by the way, in the 19th century, and particularly in the development of Gogol and Dostoevsky, and he was a champion of Pushkin, so he had a great impact himself, but they devoted a large part of their energies to the matter of effecting a fundamental change in the image of the hero, in calling for a literature, now listen carefully, which would serve social change. Okay? Which would serve social change. So this puts them in the camp of the moderns, obviously. But, you know, wait a minute. The saint's life, presumably, gives us a model that could lead to social change too. So it's not all that modern after all, is it? It's one of those two poles that literature is constantly vacillating between. On the one hand, pure fantasy that has nothing to do with anything, utter entertainment that takes us out of reality and leads us somewhere else and we don't have to think about it very much. And on the other hand, pure propaganda for whatever happens to be your concern, your program for the perfection of the world. Right, so in calling for a literature which would serve social change, they had first to isolate and define the characteristics of the hero they wanted to replace. And generalizations they made about Oblomovism. Now, Oblomov is the hero or protagonist of a very well-known novel, but we're not going to be reading it. And it's not as great a novel as the ones we will be reading, but it's a very interesting novel. It's 600 pages long. It's about a man who almost never gets out of bed. The only thing that gets him out of bed is he falls in love. And for a while, it looks as though his entire life, as he has known it, is threatened. But then you know, the love affair doesn't blossom, and he, with great relief, returns to his bed.
What novel is this?
It's called Oblomov. Oblomov. And Turgenev, whose Fathers and Sons we will read, and it's a very important Russian novel. But he also wrote a shorter work called The Diary of a Superfluous Man. I was very interested to notice that in French, that was translated as The Diary of a Man Who Was Too Much, One Too Many, Superfluous. Un homme de trop. One man too many. So, in short, one man too many is somebody who just doesn't belong to society. You know, the outsider, the outcast. You heard about this in literature before? Maybe. Well, we got a lot of this in Western literature after a certain point, particularly during the Romantic era. But more about that later. All right, so the superfluous man. So they attack the single characteristic of the dominant hero type in the 19th century, by the mid-century, which they most hope to change, his overwhelming predilection for defeat. Okay, so you see the Igor Alexander Nevsky polarity here. The reasons for the emphasis on failure might be sought, they felt, in various hypotheses that life offered no other significant types, that tragedy was somehow rooted in the nature of the novel form, that the celebration of fallibility, the worship of sorrow, were basic to the tradition of European literature and to the worldview of the writers themselves. None of these justifications seemed to the radical critics to be valid deterrents to the creation of a more effective and more successful literary hero. Now notice they're attributing all of this to decadent Western literature, not to Russian literature, because they were Narodnost themselves, you know, they were nationalist. And in fact, what they were looking for was a positive national model. But they were modernizers. They believed in progress. And the positive hero then will be a man who will lead us out of this medieval marsh that we've been stuck in for, well, many, many centuries, perhaps for almost a millennia by 1800.
Just so when they were talking about overwhelming predilection for defeat, were they not referring to their own literature, but to like Western European literature? Or just European literature in general?
Contemporary Western literature. So this is the 1840s and 1850s. Okay. Think about what's going on in Europe in the first half of the 19th century. We have at the end of the 18th century, we have this interest in the bizarre and the out of the way and the fantastic, the Gothic novel, for example. Then we have an interest in the romance and the revival of medieval themes, and Sir Walter Scott primarily. He was very, very popular all over Europe, and he was translated into French and German and, yes, Russian. And in fact, Lermontov's hero and a hero of our time mentions Sir Walter Scott particularly. So they all read them. They all read him and these other novels. Then we get the Romantics and the flawed hero, and in particular, the Byronic hero, who from Pushkin on, and even before Pushkin, but certainly with Pushkin and Lermontov, the Byronic hero is a very, very important figure in Russian literature. So this is what they're talking about. They're talking about the, you know, Byron wrote a play called Cain, that is Abel's brother. And Cain, not Abel, is the hero. And he's been wronged. He's been wronged. He's a social outcast. He's the hero. this sort of thing. Huh?
He misunderstood.
Yes, that's right. He was misunderstood by God himself. Well, you know how it is. Some people can never get a hearing. Right. So I'll just read a little bit more of this so that you'll see the extent of this whole theme in the novels we're going to read. Seen as a type which dominated Russian literature for a century, the kind of hero they opposed is a complex figure apart from his habit of failure. The men without hope, Pechorin, the hero of our time, Lermontov. Stavrogin, we'll be reading about him before too long in Dostoevsky's The Devils, sometimes translated as The Possessed. And Prince Andrei from Tolstoy's War and Peace, which we will not be studying this semester. They are successful in their rebellious search for annihilation. The men of hope and good intentions fail, in spite of themselves, to live as they plan to or to fulfill the apparent promise of their lives. Such are Turgenev's ego-centered heroes manqué, each with his special personality failure. Rudin's fatal eloquence, Lavretsky's weakness disguised as scruple, Bazarov's narcissistic arrogance. These are from three different novels of the novelist Turgenev, whose Fathers and Sons has as its principal figure Bazarov. For the radical critics, both these types are characterized by a disastrous alienation from other human beings and from purposeful activity. For the radical critics, it was the inactivity resulting from this maladjustment which linked all these figures, disparate though they were in character and motivation. And so, there you have, then, a very interesting and complicated theme that then goes along with this peculiar Russian character. On the one hand, an inferiority complex that doesn't get addressed until Peter the Great. Russia was considered a barbaric, huge backwater by Europe. Peter the Great turned this backwater into a world power, something to be reckoned with, and he did it in his lifetime. Now that's something. Well, let's see. What did he do? Let's look at the western half of the Soviet Union. Says here, my guidebooks are really out of date. My venerable, next time you go to Russia, which was prepared by the State Department, it's falling apart. But that's what this map is from. And in fact, things haven't changed that much if you understand that Uzbekistan is now independent, but it's part of the Confederation of Independent States. Yeah, it doesn't seem very different. All right, so we're down here to Turkey and the Black Sea, all the way up to the White Sea, Arkhangelsk. This is, did you see the James Bond movie that opens in Arkhangelsk? Well, that's, there it is, way up there. It's cold up here. And there is Lake Onega, which gives the name to Pushkin's superfluous man, Eugene Onegin. There's an opera by Tchaikovsky, by the way, based on it, but I don't think that's coming up this season. All right, and then there's the Baltic Sea. Now look where Russia really is up there. Look, you can go all the way down to Turkey, practically. It borders on Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Romania. In other words, then the Austro-Hungarian Empire, formerly the Holy Roman Empire, all the way up to Finland, where it shares a border all the way up, a land border, that is, and then Sweden and so on and so forth. So a constant threat from Sweden. And Peter the Great decided, after he settled a few family matters, that is, getting rid of a half-brother and half-sister who were co-rulers.
Killed them?
Well, he made things uncomfortable for him. He did execute, well, he didn't quite. He was on the way to executing his own son for treason, Alexei, but he died before he could be executed. Apparently, he had evidence of a plot against him. So Peter the Great was sometimes a bit ruthless, as a matter of fact, but at the same time, a man with an unbelievable political imagination, grandiose. And, you know, it's interesting, the modernist writers in the early 19th century, the ones who were creating all these heroes, also liked another man who was similar to Peter the Great, Napoleon the First. You heard of him? So, what happens? He defeats the Swedes. The Swedes were this problem, you see. They'd been a problem since before Alexander Nevsky. He defeats the Swedes, and he liberates this area right over here. Now we can see it a little bit better. And he creates what he calls a window on the west. Moscow is, well, it's not really on the map here. It's out over here somewhere. That was the capital, of course, after it was moved from Kiev during the Middle Ages. He creates this total new planned city on what is basically an icy marsh where three rivers come together. All have Neva in their names. And so if you look at this, you'll notice, okay, this is the only port they've got to connect to Europe. Now this is interesting in another way. He worked in a shipyard as a young man. He learned to build ships. Maybe it's no coincidence that he understood that Russia needed a really good port that could be defended, but that also could be the launching point for trade with the West. He went beyond just doing a yeoman's duty. Now, I don't know how you go incognito throughout Europe when you're almost 7 feet tall, but he did. He traveled throughout Europe, and in a way, he was something of a spy, a cultural spy, you might say. He looked all about him, and he decided what he wanted, and he went back to this godforsaken, awful place, which you'll read about in Dostoevsky, and in actually Gogol, too, talks about it. The winds that sweep through Petersburg are terrible. The great monumental buildings and canals don't corral the winds at all. The Neva freezes over. It's a beautiful city, but oh my God, it must be, you know, like the last circle of hell. All right, so you get the idea. He can protect all of this area now from the Swedes and from the Germans. And by the way, they had a spot of Poland all to their own, and they had some of Lithuania and the rest. They'd gotten the Germans out of there. This is an aerial view, just to give you an idea up here. So you can see the coastline and these fjord-like rivers all the way through. And this is a view of modern St. Petersburg. By the way, its original name was Petersburg, and then later the name was changed to Petrograd, rather interestingly, the city of Peter. And that's ambiguous, isn't it? Because is it St. Peter or is it Peter the Great? And then finally, of course, it's named Leningrad. And then in 1991, the citizens of Leningrad voted to name their, call their city not Petrograd anymore, but St. Petersburg. See, there's some things you can never get rid of. And the today I was reading something I thought was very interesting. There is an extreme right-wing Orthodox group in Russia that thinks that said they considered Alexander Nevsky to be one of the patron saints of the Russian Secret Service.
Wow.
Yeah. See, this is what I sometimes wonder if Western politicians haven't read enough Russian novels and studied enough Russian history. There's never been a separation of the two. And what Peter the Great did was just kind of clean it up. Of course, he had a model from Constantinople anyway, so it was nothing new. But what he did was organize it a little bit better so that the churches, which had a tendency to be quite independent of one another, were brought under a central umbrella. But we don't have much time to discuss that. Here is the central area of Leningrad, that is now, in once again, St. Petersburg. The main street in St. Petersburg is Nevsky Prospect. You'll read, it goes down here and off and off and off. And on one end, there is a church, the Church of the Holy Trinity. And on the other end, there is the monastery of St. Alexander Nevsky. Alexander Nevsky Lavra, where his body resides. Right, so a church and a monastery at each end. That ought to tell you something. But also, you notice it ends in the Admiralty. And this building is in a sort of U shape, or it's like the Russian P or the Greek pi. And this used to be a great dock for ships. But they discovered they didn't need it that much. And so they turned it into offices. And the Admiralty then is one of those fine, shining examples of bureaucracy that you read about all through Russian literature. Next to it is the Winter Palace, where the Tsar spent his winter months. And next to that is the Hermitage, which is now a very famous museum. And they started getting pictures for the Hermitage all the way back in the late 18th century. And it is one of the outstanding collections of Western art in the world, all the way up to Picasso and Matisse and beyond. There are gardens all over. It's a city of canals like Venice. And yes, Peter the Great went to Venice. And there are some buildings there that we can look at to get an idea. Now, it was for the early 18th century an up-to-date, thoroughly modern city. Planned out, you can see it's got a grid plan. The streets follow certain very precise patterns, as do the canals. But the first part of it that was built was the fortress of Saints Peter and Paul. So you see it here and you see it up there, and we can get a better look at it. This is on one side of the Neva River, and it's facing the Admiralty and the Hermitage and the Winter Palace, okay? So on the other side of that is that collection of buildings. This is the fortress. So he built a fortress first in case the Swedes came back. Then, here it is, he built the Peter Paul Cathedral. And in the Peter Paul Cathedral, by the way, this church has this remarkable spire that looks almost like a TV antenna going up, or a radio antenna. And it was in turn modeled on a spire in a Moscow church. That spire was destroyed by a wind or something, I forget what, or maybe a fire. But in any case, it's a taller spire. And this is very interesting because it indicates that in Moscow, which did not at this time have very much in the way of Western architecture, there was nevertheless, there were the beginnings of some influence of the West on Russian ecclesiastical architecture, at least. So this is the Peter Paul Fortress, and this is the great spire of the Peter Paul Cathedral. There's spires all over Petersburg, and there's a one like this, not quite as tall, by the Admiralty, and it has a ship on the top. So you can see, you see across, there is the Admiralty and the Hermitage and the rest, where Nevsky Prospect begins. Okay. Guess who's buried there? That's quite a roll call, isn't it? Peter the Great, Catherine the First, now not Catherine the Great yet, she's number six. She died in 1796. Her son, Paul the First. So the Tsarinas were also buried there with their husbands,
yeah,
all the way up to Alexander the Third. So one last look at the Peter Paul Fortress in the surrounding area. Now, think about it for a moment. When you look at this architecture, you suddenly realize how Peter the Great was able to make Russia into a world power. He scared everybody. he built magnificently because his armies were not interested in invading anything around their historical territory. They were interested in maintaining it, of course. But it was mainly a question of one-upmanship, I think, and prestige on the world stage. So here's the Winter Palace, the New Hermitage, and the other buildings. There are lots of gardens all over Petersburg. And there's the Admiralty Tower over there and the Admiralty building. And this is the Winter Palace. Not bad for a backwater. And notice the, by the way, who were the architects for these buildings? Russian architects? Oh no. German, French, and Italian architects. But there is something about them that is not, well, obviously, the domes here are not. But there is something about them, they're not altogether copies of Western architecture. There's a definite Russian style to them, even though they're obviously neoclassical. This is one of the monumental staircases in the Winter Palace, a hallway in the Hermitage, a sculpture gallery, ceiling with frescoes. Now, what did churches look like typically before this? They were houses and churches were built of wood. And this is a magnificent example of total wooden church architecture. Look at those amazing onion domes on this one. Let's take a closer look. That's all wood. I've got a better one right here, so you can see more closely.
Were they octagonal in shape?
The churches, yes. Now, I'm glad you asked that because I forgot to point out that the Peter Paul Cathedral, you know, was on a Western basilical plan and not an Orthodox central, or not quite central, but more, shall we say, polygonal plan. So these churches are, these, by the way, are up at Onega, and they are wood. construction. But Petersburg is built in stone. Now, how many rocks do you think they had there on the coast? You know what Peter did? He said that everybody who visited the city had to bring 3 stones with them. No joke. And they used it for the architecture. No big deal, you know. Carry some rocks with you. We'll appreciate it. This is the Church of the Resurrection, and it's off a canal, and I've got a lot of shots of this. So this is traditional Russian architecture. This is what you'll find in Moscow. You'll find both kinds in Petersburg, though the neoclassical dominates the city. There's another, there it is from the canal, presumably from the bridge. And now look, cheek by jowl with a nice neoclassical building. But look at the icon-like mosaics. On the other hand, by the way, they're not traditional iconic formulae here. They had been for some time now touched by Italian and Western styles that are more realistic. So, how do you like that? Great place for the Sunday liturgy. Hmm? Mm-hmm. Wow. That's a nice picture. This was on the CIA website. They have a sense of composition and beauty, though. This is the Church of St. Nicholas. And it is obviously a neoclassical church that looks reminiscent of St. Peter's. And this is the entrance to the 19th century train station. Now, the train is terribly important in the 19th century. We'll see trains in the novels. But it was the Trans-Siberian Railroad that made it possible, finally, to bring these vast, scattered domains under control. So that what would have taken, months, if not a lifetime, from one end of Russia to the other, now could be crossed in a matter of a few weeks. And you'll see that this is part of the modern theme in the novels, that the railway station, or the railway, is very often referred to. In fact, Dostoevsky's Idiot begins in a train. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What year was the Trans-Siberian Railroad constructed?
1850s. Okay. So there you have it, you see. Not too shabby, as they say. This is the Trinity Bridge. And there are bridges all over the place, and there are canals all over the place. It looks like a kind of 18th century Venice. This is Nevsky Prospect at night. It's over 2 miles long. It's the main thoroughfare of the city, and certainly the longest street that I know of in Russia. So there it is again, just to give you a look at it, except that it continues way down here. Now, that's not the end of it. There's Petrodvorets, which used to be called Peterhof in Russian. Petrodvorets. This is was the court of Peter the Great, and he designed the buildings himself. So outside of Petersburg, up here, all along here on the coast, you've got a series down at Pulkovo and Pushkin and Pavlovsk. You've got a series of palaces. So if you thought that Petersburg was impressive. When you go along the coast here and further down and see all of these palaces, you realize that they're pretty impressive in their own right. So here is a plan of Petrodvorec or Peterhof gardens, and notice the very clear Western influence here from Rome. This could be the Piazza del Popolo in Rome. Kind of gorgeous, isn't it? Lavish.
What fountain is that?
Sorry?
Do you know what the name of that fountain is?
Yes, it's the Samson Fountain. Samson is a figure, of an allegorical figure of Russia during this period. There's Samson in the center. Pushkin, there's the Alexander Palace up here, and the Catherine Palace that was built by Catherine the Great. And then finally, Pavlovsk. And again, you can tell just from this, I didn't have time to stuff all of this with pictures, and as a matter of fact, I'm not going to have time to finish if I don't hurry up. So we're going to move right along. There's Catherine the Great. There's her son, Paul the First. And this is the Bronze Horseman. It's a statue by a French sculptor by the name of Falconet. And it was constructed during the reign of Catherine. And it says Peter here and Catherine here in the inscription. And for our purposes, what's interesting about it, there are two things that are interesting about it. As a monument, it stands not far from the Admiralty, in fact, in a square of its own, which is now called the Decembrists' Square. So there it is, and you can see the Neva River over there. Now, what's a Decembrist? A Decembrist in Russian history is somebody who tries to perform a coup in December. This was in 1825, and nobody was happy about Tsar Nicholas I. And little wonder, because he was a pretty savage fellow in some ways. So it was an attempted revolt. The reprisals were, in some ways, considering surprisingly mild. Five leaders were hanged, and a number of them were sent to Siberia. But now, this is going to lead us into the Dostoevskian era. Pushkin was out of town at his country estate and couldn't get back because the roads were frozen. But he had sympathies with this revolt. And he later told the Tsar, you know, if I'd been there, I'd have probably been in the square demonstrating. But by then, he was a famous author, and the Tsar said, okay, all right, it's all right. I know. And it initiated this century-long duel between the intelligentsia and the government. And this lasts all the way up to the beginning of the 20th century. Mm-hmm.
So it was just a demonstration? They weren't even trying to overthrow it?
Oh no, they had some.
Oh,
they had weapons. Yeah, it was a coup attempt. Oh sure.
I was like, you can be sent to Siberia for demonstrating.
Oh, you could be sent to Siberia for less than that.
Really?
Dostoevsky was sent to Siberia for reading an article.
For reading an article?
Hmm.
We'll hear about that. You'll learn all these things in good time.
Yeah.
Good time.
So this is a contemporary engraving showing the Decembrists. And this is Tsar Nicholas I in Berlin on a state visit. There's a better picture of him. He doesn't look that ominous, does he? Looks a little wary. This is the assassination of Alexander II. Now, this is in the 1850s. Yes, an anarchist blew him up with a bomb. And again, you know, this is prime stuff for understanding what Dostoevsky is talking about in The Devils and elsewhere. And of course, Raskolnikov is yet another one of our superfluous men, along with the unnamed character in Notes from Underground, also by Dostoevsky. This is Pushkin's own drawing of the statue. Notice that Peter the Great is not there, but the snake that the hind legs of the horse are trampling is there. This the snake represents ignorance and all sorts of other things. What can't a snake represent? This is the actual statue, and now you can see Petro Katarina there, and the date, 1780,
in Roman letters.
Roman letters, yes. The whole thing.
How ethnically Russian were the monarchs?
Huh? They're totally ethnically Russian.
Okay, I didn't know if there were some like...
Most of them... Well, most of them were descended from the Romanov families, or as people here say, the Romanovs.
Uh-huh. I thought Catherine the Great was German.
She was by... It's complicated. She was part German, yes. This is the disastrous flood that is described in Pushkin's poem. So there was a huge flood in St. Petersburg that created all kinds of havoc and wrought damage everywhere. And so...
Was it the year before the December?
It was the year before, in 1824. And this is the square that was built for the statue. And here's the horse trampling the snake, and there it is at the entrance to the, you can see the side of the Admiralty and the giant gate that this square is adjacent to. And there's Peter looking very full of foresight. The stone that it's on is called the Stone of Thunder. It was a feat getting that. It was 60 miles away. They brought it by. They had to put it on sledges and drag it by manpower to the river. This is how they got this huge stone there. And then, once the square was in place, I mean, once the square had been set up, you'll see what this is all about here, but then they put it on a barge with two ships pulling it and brought it to the shore and unloaded it. I forget how many tons it is. It's a very impressive figure. And then they inaugurated it, and this is what we were seeing before. They had it enclosed in a kind of box, and they opened the box with fireworks. And amazing, isn't it? And there's Pushkin himself. Now, I have a nifty edition of the poem here, but I'll simply give you a quick, as I said, it's not terribly long. It has a prologue. What's remarkable about the poem is that it takes place at the time of the flood. And on the one hand, there's this magnificent statue and monument to Peter the Great. On the other hand, there is a poor man whose home is destroyed by the flood, and it kills his fiancée as well. And he goes up to the statue and shakes his fist at the statue, and the statue starts to chase him. And it chases him all through Petersburg. And what's interesting about this poem, which is, some people say it's the greatest poem in Russian literature, is that it doesn't take sides. It sees both the plight of the helpless madman, who's been driven mad by his losses in the flood, and on the other hand, the great benefits that Peter brought to Russia. So this is one side of the coin, you might say. Or it's a two, like most coins, it has two sides. But one side of the coin then is the terrible sacrifice that was necessary on the part of the Russian people to build this magnificent monument. On the other hand, what it did was create something that all Europe now had to be aware of. So you could say that this is the moment when our two heroes get united in Pushkin's poem, in a certain sense, but with a certain Russian twist. Now it's the poor, the dispossessed. Oh, incidentally, it was Alexander II who freed the serfs in the 1850s. And the assassination occurred not long after that. He wasn't assassinated for freeing the serfs, by the way. He was pretty much forced into it by circumstances. Well, just a quick note about Mikhail Lermontov, and the hero of our time, and Eugene Onegin of Pushkin. These are two of the most significant early versions of the superfluous man. Eugene Onegin is this bored young man who, well, he likes to lead people on, but then he tires of them. And a young woman named Tatiana, she's in her teens, she's read a lot of novels, all Western, of course, and she falls madly in love with him, and he pays her no attention. He has a friend who's a not very good poet, and the friend is engaged to Tatiana's sister, and because of a little, he gets miffed at his poet friend, Lesky, and decides to make him angry. So at a ball, he flirts with the fiancée. And Lesky challenges his friend Onegin to a duel. They go to the duel, and Onegin says, look, I don't want to do this. I don't care. I don't care whether I live or die. But Lesky persists. He kills his friend in a duel and has to leave. In the meanwhile, by the way, the fiancé, a few months afterwards, marries somebody else. Meanwhile, Tatiana, who still longs after Onegin, who won't pay any attention to her, ends up going to Moscow, and there she ends up marrying a very prominent general. Onegin comes back after being exiled to the south for his duel. That's what they usually did with these dueling types. By the way, Pushkin died in a duel at the age of 37, Russia's greatest poet. Somebody had insulted him by trying to play up to his wife. In any event, Onegin comes back, and now he falls in love with Tatiana, but she's married, and the whole thing ends inconclusively. Tatiana brushes him off and says, no, I've already made up my mind now. And you say, what? What kind of story is this? Well, what's going on here is, in fact, a kind of repudiation of the Byronic hero. In fact, the whole poem is mostly about Russia caught culturally between two worlds. And so it's a kind of remarkable instance of a poem that seemed to capture the mood, not just of a moment, but of a whole century. And in fact, in The Bronze Horseman and in Eugene Onegin, two of Pushkin's greatest works, Pushkin also does something else that nobody had done before him. He invents Russian literature. That is, he invents a modern literature that, for the first time, launches what will become the complicated Russian novel. It's a novel in verse, and it's short. And it's not really a novel in some ways. It's ironic throughout. The poet talks about himself, the narrator, as much as he talks about his hero. In fact, it's what I would call, using the term from another course I teach, more or less a Menippean satire. He does, the hero is not a hero at all. In fact, it's a sort of, if you will, critique of the whole romantic mode. And this same thing happens in Lermontov's A Hero of Our Time, who was, by the way, a precocious young man and is sometimes considered second as a poet only to Pushkin. He was, he was 15 years younger than Pushkin. He also died in a duel at the age of 27. But he wrote this novel and published it a year before Gogol's Dead Souls. And I'll tell you some about that next time because it's directly relevant for what we get in Gogol. Okay? Any other questions? Wonderful.
So we start Dead Souls next time.
We made it.
Yeah.
We saw all the pictures.
Just to clarify two things. First of all, this Song of Igor's Campaign and Bronze Horseman, the Ipping Online, are those assigned readings for next time? Okay, but just for like our information.
For your information.
Then I will like look at them, but don't have to worry about cramming the readings with everything else.
They're just so that you might skim them to see what my very inadequate and brief summary is all about.
That would be great, actually.